From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. This program would not be possible without the generous support of State of Belief listeners. We're very thankful for that support. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's show, and I want to warn you in advance that it's a particularly thought-provoking show, in my opinion. The topics that we'll be discussing don't lend themselves to oversimplification or bumper sticker sloganeering. They require careful consideration, and that's what we're going to endeavor to do during this next hour.
This president's foreign policy is the most speckless in American history. He's so naive, he would trust the Iranians, and he would take the Israelis and basically march them to the door of the oven.
The reaction to that incredible statement from presidential candidate Mike Huckabee generated a lot of outrage. But the ordained minister and former Arkansas governor has stuck to his guns, and it may be a while before we know if, in the age of Trump, indeed anything goes. Admirably, former Florida governor and fellow White House wannabe Jeb Bush has called for civility in the race. But what are the odds of that happening? Meanwhile, openly secular socialist Bernie Sanders is drawing huge crowds, and the entire Republican-run legislature seems committed to taking Hillary Clinton down at all costs. We'll overview the race and the rhetoric when I'm joined once again by Greg LaBelle, Assistant Professor of Political Management at George Washington University.
Several Republican presidential candidates are now asking for a constitutional amendment banning same-sex marriage.
You don't have to be a Christian to be affected by loss of religious liberty. Because if one liberty is taken, more liberties will be taken.
Well, let me ask you how tolerant you are. Do you think those two bakers in Oregon who had to lose their business because they wouldn't bake a cake for a lesbian wedding, do you think they should have their business closed because of that?
There are many of us who feel strongly that recent and pending advances for LGBT Americans are way overdue. Since we believe in inclusivity and fairness because of our faith convictions, not in spite of them, we're not caught up in the struggle between what some see as restrictions on their religious liberty and the cause of the rights of others. But this is a very real struggle for many Americans right now, and it would be foolish to dismiss it. An articulate analysis of the current state of affairs appeared in the pages of The Atlantic magazine, and on this week's show, I'll talk to the author, managing editor Emma Green. But first,
I think this is a terrible historic mistake.
This negotiation is not the art of fantasy or the art of the ideal. It's the art of the possible.
The stakes could not be higher. As Congress weighs the groundbreaking nuclear deal hammered out between Iran on the one side and the U.S. and its partners on the other, a lot of it comes down to trust. Trust for Iran is horrendously low, which is certainly understandable. Many who support the deal don't trust GOP lawmakers to refrain from partisan politics. Many who are skeptical have zero confidence in the Obama administration and Secretary of State John Kerry. It's reasonable to expect faith leaders to be able to rise above this kind of divisiveness, but inevitably, these leaders then risk coming across as being too political themselves and thereby losing trust as well. Last week, a bold call to refrain from giving in to that fear appeared in the Washington Post, headlined, "Should Rabbis Really Be Wading Into the Debate Over the Iran Deal?" It was written by Rabbi Jill Jacobs, executive director of TRUA, the Rabbinic Call for Human Rights. And I'm very happy right now that brings Rabbi Jacobs back to State of Belief Radio. Jill, welcome.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be with you.
When the topic of Iran comes up, I can't help but feel like I'm walking on eggshells. There are some who immediately call any talk of negotiations naive and even anti-Israel. So let's begin with me asking you, how can we prevent those kinds of reactions from shutting down the conversation before it ever begins?
That's a great place to start. I think that those reactions do sometimes shut down the conversation. And this is an issue in which we have to have nuance. We can't pretend that Iran is suddenly going to become our best friend, even if we sign this agreement or any agreement tomorrow. And we also can't get stuck in the place of believing that because Iran does have a terrible human rights record and because some of its leaders have a record of calling for the destruction of Israel and the United States, that that means that we have to be stuck in that forever, that we can't move to a better situation with them and certainly prevent Iran from getting nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. And I think that what's most important, especially for those of us who are rabbis or ministers or other kinds of clergy, is to acknowledge those fears. There are real and important fears about Iran, about what Iran will do with its money, mm-hmm. and we have to acknowledge those. We have to speak in our pastoral voice. We can't just pretend those don't exist.
Mm-hmm.
And we also have to be able to give our people hope.
The stakes are incredibly high. You start out your piece by saying centrifuges, snapbacks, and fissile materials weren't covered in rabbinic school. Well, they weren't covered in Christian seminaries either. So what's your answer to the question posed in the headline, should rabbis really be wading into the debate over the Iran deal?
My answer is yes. It's a very clear yes. But the more complicated question is, how should rabbis be walking in? And there's a distinction between rabbis or any kind of clergy people and people who are policy experts or people who are nuclear physicists. Where rabbis and other clergy sometimes get stuck is that we think that we have to be the policy analysts, that that's what's being demanded from us, that we have to know all of the answers to all of the policy questions. That's not the voice that we should be speaking from. The voice we should be speaking from is the moral, religious voice, and that's a voice that is both pragmatic, that is serious and real about the risks, the stakes, that is pastoral, that acknowledges people's fears, and also that speaks from our traditions. All religions, I believe, and certainly Judaism, teach us that the world doesn't have to be the way the world is right now.
Mm-hmm.
So because we have certain assumptions about what Iran is and how Iran acts, and we have assumptions about whether the rhetoric is going to translate into action, sometimes we just get stuck there, and that means we can't take any steps mm-hmm. forward into a peaceful solution. But rabbis and other clergy can help us to get out of that and to help us see that, in fact, there's a possibility that the world can be very different from how it is today.
I know a lot of people, and you probably do too, who say faith leaders ought to just stay out of this kind of thing altogether. Talk about what we lose when faith leaders exempt themselves from addressing the most volatile issues of the day.
We lose religion, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
I know this is work that you've been doing for your entire career, that it's just not true to think that religion is somehow separate from the world, because, in fact, religion is all about the world. When I look at the Torah, I can't even get past chapter 1 without finding out that all human beings are created in the image of God, which is a powerful message about how we treat other human beings, about our liability when we damage or kill another human being, and our obligations to ensure the health and safety and dignity of all human beings. So that's just in chapter 1. And then when we get past that, just even still staying in the Torah, we find commandments about how we treat our workers. We find systems of how to set up law courts, how to make sure that law courts are fair. We find laws about what warfare should and shouldn't look like.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, once we get into the prophets, of course, they keep reminding the people that it's not enough to just do rituals, that, in fact, we also have obligations to engage with the world, that our rituals and God's acceptance of our rituals are, in fact, dependent on how we act in the world. And then when we get into later Jewish law has many law codes that include civil laws.
Mm-hmm.
How do we create a criminal justice system? that ensures that both perpetrators and also victims are protected and are treated with dignity? Mm-hmm. How do we create a system that ensures that employers can't take advantage of low-wage workers? How do we ensure that the people who are in the worst economic position in our society are taken care of? On and on and on. How do we make sure that people contribute appropriately to infrastructure in their own cities? There's not a single issue of civil law or anything that we would consider political that Jewish law, and I think this is true of other religious laws also, doesn't deal with. And so some people will say rabbis should just deal with religion and shouldn't delve into contemporary issues or politics, and I don't even know what that means. That would mean essentially cutting out a huge chunk of Judaism and saying rabbis can't even talk about that part of Judaism. We can just talk about ritual law, which, as the prophets tell us, means that our rituals end up having no meaning if they're not connected to how we're acting in the world.
We want faith leaders to speak in these conversations. How can we make sure that trust in faith leaders is not compromised when we're talking about such inherently political matters?
We can't guarantee anything, but what faith leaders can do is to speak in ways that reflect our traditions. Again, not giving the same talk that a policy analyst might give, but both teaching and speaking and writing in a way that is very true to our traditions, that brings our traditions into the conversation. And we also need to create the expectation that this is what faith leaders do. We need every faith leader to be talking about current issues in the world, because that way people will stop asking this question once we assume that whatever synagogue or church or mosque we go to, that we're going to hear sermons and teaching and we're going to be participating in activities that shows that religion isn't something that just exists within mm-hmm. the sanctuary, that in fact it's something that we take into the world.
I find, even in talking with fellow clergy, that so many people don't draw a clear distinction between politics and partisan politics. I can't imagine, Jill, how one shares faith with integrity and not deal with politics. But I think you can do that all day long without getting into partisan politics.
Absolutely. A lot of people will say synagogues or churches are tax-exempt, and therefore you shouldn't wade into political issues. But that's, as you said, really confusing what's political and what's partisan. So it's absolutely true that rabbis and ministers and imams and all religious leaders should not get up and say who to vote for, and mm-hmm. should not get up and say that our religions are Republican or Democratic or anything else. It's, first of all, not true that our religions would support one party over another. So that would be crossing a line both in terms of American law and also in terms of what's true to our religions. But what's political, and by political I mean engaged with the human community, is all of the issues that we've been talking about, whether it's about international politics and this Iran agreement, whether it's about domestic issues, economic issues, social issues. All of those are places that might be political, but they're not necessarily partisan.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So when you try to implement what we've just said, what are some of the fundamental tests that you apply when weighing contemporary issues in terms of their political nature and in terms of really timeless religious teachings?
The first and most important test is this coming from the depths of religious tradition? Is the person who's teaching on this issue, and I think especially about the Jewish community because that's the one that I'm immersed in, so is the rabbi in this case looking at Jewish texts and really thinking deeply about how these texts might engage the issue? That's different from, for example, deciding how he or she approaches the issue in the beginning and then pulling a text, just one verse or something like that, to prove a point. So is this really engaging with the issue? Is the person coming to it with an open mind and with real questions and without preconceived ideas based on political affiliation about how this issue should play out? This is something that has been especially true in the Iran agreement, that we've seen the pro and con voices mostly split out along political lines, and most of the positions really came out either before the deal was signed or so quickly after the deal was agreed upon that nobody could have had a chance to read and process the material. And so it very much has felt like people on both sides were coming in with an assumption about where they would fall without understanding exactly what it is that we were arguing about. So are we coming in with an open mind? And are we open to dialogue? Are we having a conversation within our communities that brings in voices both from our tradition and also brings those voices into conversation with the real live experience of human beings, with research, with other kinds of voices, and a conversation that will improve the public discourse?
I think one of the most harmful contributions that the religious right has made to thought in our nation is taking policy issues and determining a person's authenticity in religion on the basis of their position on a particular policy.
I don't think that anybody should be going around declaring who is or who isn't religious, or who is or who isn't a good Jew or a good Christian, or who is or who isn't worshiping God in the right way. That's not for us to figure out. God can figure all of that out later, and it doesn't help anything for us to be labeling each other in that way. It only hurts the conversation and the discourse.
You sit in a place that deals with issues that are almost always controversial to some extent.
Yep.
Right now, you're dealing with an issue in which, from both outside religion and inside religion, people are talking about a decision and its direct impact on the Jewish religion. How do you feel about that? How are you handling that? Because I know that the stakes are high and the statements are more in absolutes than they should be. How do you deal with that?
The stakes are definitely high. And of course, the reason that anyone in the Jewish community, including myself, has said anything at all is because we're worried and we're scared. And we understand that the place that is most in danger is Israel, and the people who are most in danger are Jews. So that's the reason that we're concerned, and that leads us to different places. So for some people, that leads to a place of wanting to reject this agreement or any agreement that isn't perfect or potentially any agreement at all, depending on the person. And for some people, that leads us to a place of saying, this is the agreement that makes sure that there won't be a nuclear weapon that's pointed at Israel at least any time in the next 15 years, during which, of course, much of global politics can shift and hopefully will bring Iran into the international community. But that's what's motivating this, and it's very important to continue reminding ourselves and our people of that, that we all want the same thing in the end. And that's where, as I said in that article, that's where this issue is perhaps somewhat different from, for example, the healthcare debate, where in the healthcare debate, there were some people who said there needs to be national healthcare, there's an obligation of the state to provide healthcare for its people, and there were some people who said there's not, and the state doesn't have to provide healthcare. So that's not two sides wanting to get to the same conclusion. It wasn't two groups saying there is an obligation for healthcare, and now we're arguing about the details. In this situation, there's a common goal, which is we all want Israel to be safe. None of us want terrorism to get any extra money from Iran. None of us want to end up in a situation in which Jews have to worry about walking into a Jewish community center or a synagogue for fear of terrorism. So we're all coming from the same place, and then the question is, how do we best get there? And we just have to keep repeating this message, because so much of the rhetoric is about, if you care about Israel, then X, Y, or Z, and screaming like that, as opposed to saying, we all care about Israel, now let's talk about the details.
Rabbi Jill Jacobs is the executive director of TRUA, the Rabbinic Call for Human Rights. Her thoughtful article headlined, Should rabbis really be wading into the debate over the Iran deal? And it appeared in the Washington Post. Jill, as always, I really do appreciate so much your perspective, and I'm grateful to have you with us on State of Belief Radio.
Well, thank you so much.
Greg LaBelle is Assistant Professor of Political Management at George Washington University and a veteran of several presidential campaigns back in a time of kinder, gentler electioneering. I'm grateful to have access to Greg's insights and have him with us today on State of Belief Radio. Welcome back, Greg.
Thanks, Welton. I think it was a kinder and gentler era. I think you're right.
So Mike Huckabee managed to find a new low in a campaign season that was already pretty ugly to begin with. He invoked the Holocaust in criticizing the Iran nuclear deal, refused to back down in the face of public outrage, and his rhetoric received support from Rick Santorum and Ted Cruz, among others. Greg, how have we come to this?
Two words, Donald Trump. I think the big part of this is these guys who are in the lower echelons of this list of, I think it was 16 the last time I checked, they're figuring this is the way that they are going to make points right now. And so they're reverting to some of their worst instincts in attempt just to get some sort of attention.
Just be honest with me. We've been talking on State of Belief for years about politics. Did you ever believe we'd be talking about Donald Trump as a serious candidate for the presidency?
Never, ever, ever. You know that in the past he's always liked to throw the idea out there, and you know, because it gets him attention and so on and so forth. But the idea of him actually declaring his candidacy is something that I just never imagined he would do.
Yep.
So here we are.
Well, it was somewhat refreshing to hear Jeb Bush come out in favor of civility in the presidential race. But how credible is he in doing that, considering his own political reputation?
It probably does strain credibility to a certain extent. But, you know, the interesting thing is this all makes some of the candidates, particularly Jeb Bush, I think, look pretty moderate. Mm-hmm. When you've got Donald Trump out there with his daily outrage, you've got Huckabee sort of jumping on that wagon, and I think, you know, Ted Cruz and Rand Paul and Santorum in their own ways doing the same thing. It gives Jeb Bush a mm-hmm. little bit of breathing room because comparatively he doesn't look crazy.
Yeah, yeah. Presidential candidates, especially conservative ones, spend a lot of the early campaign months at gatherings with various degrees of Christian sponsorship.
Yeah.
So maybe it's not surprising that religious rhetoric bleeds into their speechifying. Have there been instances in the last couple of months that went beyond the pale, in your opinion?
Ted Cruz is just one of the guys who seems to be willing to say almost anything. And, you know, he's talked about how religious liberty has never been more threatened in America than right now, today. Cruz is really making a pitch for these folks. And, interestingly enough, I think he's also trying to, assuming that at some point Donald Trump will fall by the wayside, which may or may not be true, mm-hmm. with all the money that Donald Trump has to throw at this, and he wants to pick up those supporters. So Ted Cruz, you know, remains sort of way out there. You've got Santorum taking on the Supreme Court, talking about five unelected judges redefining the foundation of society. Rand Paul has a new book, by the way, coming out, Presidents and Their Prayers. I looked it up on Amazon.com, and I was interested to see that the two books that were recommended based on my selection of that was Michael Savage's latest book on how progressives and radical Islamists are trying to destroy Western civilization. And the other book I thought was even better. It's just called The Witches. So, you know, it's a free-for-all out there. It's an absolute free-for-all. And I think a big part of this is focused on that debate in the beginning of August. They're trying to get enough attention to get their numbers up so that they're in that top 10.
And do you really think this has been intensified by Trump?
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. Because he's taking all the air out of the room. And this is a guy who comes out, it's like the outrage of the day. all the stuff that these other candidates are saying is sort of taking, at best, second seat to whatever Donald Trump is talking about today. So, and it's frustrating the daylights out of them. So they're all trying to figure out how to do it. And, you know, Bush went into this saying that he wanted to do this in a different way. And I have to give him some credit. He seems, by and large, to be sticking to that. He has avoided, in most cases, I think, jumping on this sort of crazy bandwagon. The question is what that means for him in terms of getting votes as this process goes on, and I don't know.
The Republican candidates in the primary, have any of these guys or the woman involved said that God called them to be president?
Well, yeah, sadly, a number of Republican candidates have jumped in and pointed that out. Scott Walker, when he announced, made the statement that he was running based on what his understanding of God's plan. Ben Carson, we know, has often said that God was directing him to do things. And once again, he's saying, I believe God will make it clear to me if that's something I'm supposed to do. There are messages that are being sent out to those voters, and it's all about the godliness of the pursuit that I think is important to know. But, you know, some of these guys don't have to. I mean, you look at Rick Santorum, who went through this 4 years ago, and it was quite clear that that was sort of his motivation in all of this. This becomes part of the message, that appeal. Rick Perry is another one. I mean, this is a guy who held prayer and fast days in Texas so it would rain, much like 17th century colonial leaders did. In some ways, they don't have to say it directly because it's so much else that they can say and do that sort of makes that clear. They're sort of dog whistle kind of approach to politics where you say enough things in the right way, and the people who you want to get the message, they get the message. They understand what you're talking about.
In the election 4 years ago, all of the candidates who claimed God's endorsement made God look like a bad politician.
Yeah, I think that, you know, it's that old Lincoln quote, the question is not whether God is on our side, but whether we're on God's side.
I agree. How significant is it that Fox News seems ready to unilaterally decide which Republican candidates fit into the national spotlight?
Yeah. Some people at Fox News, most people at Fox News, for different reasons, are probably already really sorry that they went down this road, because I think we've only begun to see the discontent among the candidates as we get closer to the debate itself, because there's an arbitrariness to this that really just doesn't make sense. They would argue that logistically they have no choice with so many people running. But you're right. Fox News creates a first tier and a second tier. And that's the first time that this has ever happened, certainly on this scale. They've made that decision that, you know, 10 of them will make the debate. It's sort of like the daytime and the nighttime Emmys. You know, the little guys get the daytime show, and the people who really matter, according to Fox, end up getting under the Klieg lights for the big show.
Okay, tell us what to make of Bernie Sanders and his phenomenon.
Well, I think that Sanders certainly has struck a chord with a large number of liberals, and they find his approach really refreshing. He's tapped into that anti-Wall Street sentiment. He has also tapped into that desire for someone who's unscripted out there telling the truth, whatever that means. So there's a great deal of interest in him for that reason. I suspect, and we've seen this before, maybe not quite as dramatically as this, but we've seen this before. I think as time goes on, I think that the appeal, as voters get closer to actually having to make choices, some of that appeal, I think, is going to wear thin, because I think you'll hear more and more talk about wasting my vote. Mm-hmm. I love Bernie Sanders. I think he's great, but I don't want to waste my vote. Mm-hmm. And so they may move in another direction. If Hillary Clinton continues to dominate the field, sometimes in spite of herself, I think a number of those votes will go there. If for some reason Clinton continues to be increases in that level of unacceptability, Martin O'Malley may begin to pick up some of those four votes. Mm-hmm. Martin O'Malley's a smart guy. He's out there working hard, and he's barely registering in the polls. But I think some of that, as we get closer to actual voting, I think some of that Sanders vote probably peels off a little bit because of just that basic concept of strategic voting.
Greg, is it fair to say that all of the questioning and criticism of Hillary Clinton by members of Congress and various committees is taking an unfair toll? Is that stuff partisan, or is she bringing some of this on herself?
There have been some significant gaffes that we're all aware of, going back to the statement about how when they left the White House, She and the president were flat broke. That was an example of a tin ear that is hard to match. I think the campaign and the candidate are doing better, but I think the problem is, the challenge is, again, back to the media. You know, the media is always looking for a story, and they like to prop up people who are sort of underdogs sometimes, and they like to kind of hammer on people who are doing particularly well. But the other issue here is, I think the media also tends to create a framework in which to see a candidate, a sort of narrative about the candidate. And so the stories all tend to focus around that narrative. And I think, unfortunately for the Clinton folks, a little bit of that narrative is now about Hillary Clinton's tin ear and her gaffes. And so the media sort of looks for those things and I think amplifies them beyond probably what they deserve.
Mm-hmm. What else are you going to be keeping an eye on during the next month or two? In other words, what external forces could have a significant impact on the way the race moves forward?
Money is going to be obscenely present in this race. And the question becomes, as we saw 4 years ago, when one or two very wealthy individuals propped up a candidate like Newt Gingrich, who was able to stay in the race long beyond where he would have in any other time because he was being financed by one wealthy guy out in Nevada. I think the super PACs and these individuals, the work that the Koch brothers are doing and so on and so forth, may prop up some folks on the Republican side beyond what they're entitled to in terms of what we would usually measure as a reasonable approach to these candidacies. Mm-hmm. So the question is, does anybody actually drop out, fall by the wayside before we turn the corner into the fall, or is that outside money so prevalent that those folks are going to continue to stay in and, for their various reasons, continue to take advantage of this to promote their messages, whatever they are? So money is really going to be the thing I think we need to watch for the next few months.
Greg LaBelle is Assistant Professor of Political Management at George Washington University. Having worked inside several presidential campaigns, today he serves as director of the semester in Washington Politics, as well as the Native American Political Leadership Program at GWU. Greg, as always, I am thankful for your presence and really appreciative of the contributions you've made to State of Belief Radio.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you, Wilson.
For many Americans, the situation around evolving LGBT rights couldn't be more clear. Of course, there are perspectives that couldn't be farther apart. It's about time versus the end is near. But both sides are solidly entrenched in their views. Many more Americans, however, do not fall easily into either of these categories. And for them, there are real concerns about the rapid changes they've seen in our laws and our society. A valiant attempt at addressing their concerns appeared in the Atlantic magazine under the headline, "Gay Rights May Come at the Cost of Religious Freedom." The writer is the magazine's managing editor, Emma Green, and I am very pleased to have her join me right now on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you for having me.
You know, your headline, "Gay Rights May Come at the Cost of Religious Freedom," is rather provocative. But reading your article in its entirety, it doesn't, to me, come across as particularly alarmist.
So the article I wrote is all about the legal landscape following the Supreme Court's decision on same-sex marriage. And I think there are two main points. The first is that there are a lot of questions that were raised by the ruling that we still don't know the answer to yet. So a lot of problems that have been raised that haven't been solved. And the second thing that really struck home to me is that there will probably be a lot of change happening soon on LGBT discrimination protections.
Mm-hmm.
But where those kinds of new laws get passed or new policies get put forth by federal agencies, it will come at a cost to, or at least raising questions for, religious freedom.
Mm-hmm.
The two sort of are in tension with one another, where religious groups that want exemptions to certain statutes or guidelines on providing services to people who are in same-sex marriages, for example, will need to ask for exceptions. And so those two things are in tension with one another.
I am a longtime advocate for religious freedom. And my first instinct was to say, you know, I don't think it's going to be an exception to religious freedom. I think it's going to be an expansion of some people's understanding of religious freedom.
Well, I think we have been given situations which we haven't faced explicitly before, based on the Supreme Court's rulings. And that's for a couple of reasons. The first is that even though there were many cases in the country where gay people were allowed to get married before the Supreme Court's ruling, now that it's legal in the entire country, it will change the landscape of legislation. Mm-hmm. So, for example, there were many states in the South where same-sex marriage was not legal before the ruling. There are also many states in the South that do not have laws that protect gay people against discrimination in hiring or discrimination in public accommodation. Mm-hmm. If those laws change, there's going to be tension there and new issues that get raised. And so, to your point, I think it will be a new challenge for thinking about what religious freedom actually means. Mm-hmm. What does it actually mean to violate an employer's conscience if they're being asked to, for example, provide services for a same-sex wedding ceremony or to provide spousal benefits to an employee who's part of a same-sex marriage? The other piece of context here that's new is that the Supreme Court had a decision last summer in the case on Hobby Lobby, yes, which was all about whether private business owners have to provide insurance coverage for certain types of birth control according to the new Obamacare Affordable Care Act. And the reason why this ruling is relevant is that the Supreme Court said that, yes, private business owners are capable of raising a religious freedom claim. That same type of logic may come to bear in these new cases that are raised by the same-sex marriage case.
Fundamentally, Emma, the debate often boils down to my rights versus your rights. But but isn't it really just as unprecedented to grant a business the right to a religious conscience, as in Hobby Lobby, as it is to allow a same-sex couple to marry?
Well, it's a really great point in that we're in a new time. It's a new way of thinking about employers' religious rights. Before this, there were obviously many cases that had arisen over time about religious freedom. Religious freedom is not a new thing in the United States. The United States is built on religious freedom and exceptions and trying to accommodate minorities. But you're exactly right that the way the Supreme Court imagined religious freedom claims in Hobby Lobby is much broader and more sweeping than it has been in previous rulings. So this is why it's sort of uncertain territory and will be new legal territory that needs to be explored post-same-sex marriage.
I'll be honest, a lot of the time opponents of LGBT rights destroy their own credibility with hyperbole and ad hominem attacks. While there's no way this issue gets resolved without compromises, we really do need to take the idea of curing gay people or pushing them back into the closet off the table once and for all. So what are the remaining alternatives as you see?
The point you raise is really interesting, and something that Doug Laycock, who is a professor at the University of Virginia and one of the country's leading experts on these legal issues, said to me, which I thought was really resonant, is that it's not really part of any religion to be hateful to gay people or to want to expressly discriminate against somebody because of who they are. And when we look at these cases where the two rights are in tension with one another, it is in a lot of cases of people expressly saying, you're gay, and I want to discriminate against you because you're gay. Most of the cases, the vast majority of them, are people who are raising concerns specifically with relation to marriage and their concept, mostly Christian concept, of what marriage is. So in terms of what happens next, I think it will be all about the compromise that you allude to, and some of it will be compromise on the side of envisioning broader accommodations and anti-discrimination protections for LGBT people when it comes to housing or hiring or firing or spousal benefits. But the other question will be, what will happen, for example, to individuals who raise claims about
not wanting to participate in same-sex marriage ceremonies. Mm-hmm. What will happen to adoption agencies that are run by religious organizations that don't want to place children with gay couples? What will happen to religious universities that have sexual conduct policies and don't necessarily want to change those to accommodate students who might be involved in gay relationships? Those are going to be interesting edge cases. And, you know, right now the evidence shows that probably the religious freedom claims are not going to stand, but it's a question whether and how each side will have to make a compromise.
Emma, is there a model for balanced accommodation that you think makes sense here?
Well, it's an interesting question because some of this will come down to passing laws. So creating a law like the one that was recently passed in Utah, which was a great example of the kind of balance and compromise that might be feasible. So Utah is the most recent state, and it's the 22nd out of 50 states to pass wide-ranging protections against discrimination for LGBT people. But the way that it happened was that Utah legislators met with religious leaders and were able to carve out an exemption for religious organizations, for example, that didn't want to have to hire people who are not part of their faith or who didn't accord with a certain behavioral standard. And so that carve out for religious groups could be a model that other states, and particularly states that tend to have large religious populations, could follow. The other part of this will be about litigation. So people raising these cases, saying either I have a discrimination case or I have a case where I feel like my religious freedom is being violated. And then it will be up to the courts to decide and adjudicate what actually merits a full religious freedom claim, what actually merits a discrimination claim. Is there some sort of compromise in the middle of those claims?
That's a good point. I am amazed at how much confusion exists on both sides of this issue. A majority of Americans firmly believe that anti-gay discrimination in employment is already illegal nationwide, and you and I know that's not true. A number of initiatives promising to protect the rights of clergy and of churches that object to marriage equality are getting widespread support, but they're not needed because of constitutional protections that have been in place for a long time. Do you think there is a chance of us approaching all of this in a reality-based way at some point?
I think what you're asking for is a state of politics that does not exist. Your points are exactly right, which is that there is widespread misunderstanding about the current state of affairs. So a 2014 survey by the Public Religion Research Institute found that 75% of Americans believe that there were federal laws against discrimination against gays. And you're exactly right that that is dead wrong. 75% of Americans are wrong on that point. And to the point of the Pastor Protection Act, I think a lot of that falls under political posturing, which is that you're exactly right, that pastors will in no circumstance be compelled to conduct weddings that they find to be against their conscience, nor will rabbis, nor will imams. No religious leader can be compelled by the government to conduct a wedding that it finds objection to. But, you know, there's a sense in which this issue is being treated in the same way as every other political issue that's contentious, which is people use this to rally their base. They use this to raise fear. They use it to mischaracterize a side that they find to be their opponent. And, you know, I don't think there's anything that can stop that. That's part of how politics works. There's rhetoric and there's misinformation. But I think the best thing that can happen is on a community level, trying to open our hearts in terms of tolerance and understanding and really trying to live pluralistically. And then in terms of, you know, a public information standpoint for legislators or public leaders to try to spread the right information about what's actually going on and what we do know and what we don't know.
How hopeful are you that we will, as a society, eventually find a sustainable level of accommodation on these matters? Or is this somehow an unprecedented zero-sum game that our Constitution is somehow inadequate to solve?
Well, I think from a legal perspective, I think it's a matter of time, which is these cases will be raised, and it's almost impossible to tell how they'll fall out. You know, there are so many different areas in which these two kinds of claims have to be adjudicated. And, you know, the Supreme Court last summer with Hobby Lobby handed down a surprise decision. There were a lot of people on the left in particular who were very, very surprised by the way the court ruled. So it's a little difficult to predict exactly what's going to happen. I will say that I feel confident that there will be changes and there will be movement. And one indication of that is that the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission issued a ruling within the last couple of weeks that basically said they think existing law already protects LGBT people from workplace discrimination. This is a new interpretation, and it's one that doesn't have the exact force of legislation, nor does it have the same kind of force as a Supreme Court decision might. But it is a federal agency that a lot of legislators really respect and a lot of courts give deference to. So that's one piece of movement that says to me there's going to be big change coming on this in the coming months and years, and already there are certain federal agencies, for example, that are staking out positions on it. We'll see what kinds of discrimination claims and religious freedom claims arise in the wake of that.
Emma Green is the managing editor at The Atlantic Magazine. Her comprehensive article titled Gay Rights May Come at the Cost of Religious Freedom appeared there last week. Emma, I want to thank you for sharing your great perspective so articulately with us on State of Belief Radio, and I hope that we can come back and visit with each other again as we see these changes beginning to unfold even more clearly.
Well, I would love that, and I'm so grateful for you having me on your show.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. I told you up front that we were dealing with serious matters and we would treat them seriously. I hope you think we have done that, and I hope the show was meaningful for you. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to thank you, very sincerely thank you. The ongoing financial support of our listeners is essential to keeping this show on the air. If you find value in what you're hearing, and if you think it's important that more people hear what you are hearing, I urge you to join our other generous supporters today. Please visit stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stateofbelief.com is also where you can sign up for our free weekly podcast and find links mentioned during the show. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter and share the stories you find compelling with your friends. We really need you to help spread the word. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today of Interfaith Alliance. Go to interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see, well.